United States against Roach. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron, and may it please the court. The proceedings before the court below threaten the integrity of the military justice system and the system's reputation for fairness. In order to eliminate that threat, this court should vacate the designation of Senior Judge Francis as Chief Judge for purposes of this case and everything that came after that designation. Now, obviously, I won't have time to address all four issues this morning, and absent other direction from the court, what I plan to do is begin by addressing the replacement issue, issue one, and then if there's sufficient time, move to issue two concerning sentence disparity analysis. Now, the facts that give rise to the first issue, the replacement issue, are these. Obviously, this case is before this court for a second time. Now, while this case was pending before this court initially, Chief Judge Wise made public remarks at a trial advocacy conference attended by about 150 people, during which he characterized the original panel decision in this case as a test case and indicated that the court had been faced with a conflict in precedent between Marino and May and used this case as a test case in order to resolve that. Now, after this court decided this case, but before the mandate issued, Chief Judge Wise again made public remarks about this case. And his second public remarks came in a forum for civilian law students who were interns for the Air Force. And before them, Chief Judge Wise characterized the panel's decision as an attempt to grab power from this court.
Now, we're familiar with the facts. It seems to me the issue is the government has raised the issue with you, which is if, in fact, he was, Judge Wise, was there came a time when he was required to recuse or he chose to recuse, and he engaged in some act or acts after that, inconsistent in that, the government is saying you need to show prejudice in order to lead to a decision to vacate, and you're saying it's not a requirement that there be prejudice. This is a appearance of impartiality standard or a public confidence in the system. So which is it? I know the answer you're going to give, but why is the more important part? And what is the act or acts that Judge Wise performed that gives rise to that standard of measurement?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the first question, that, you know, what is the standard, is, well first, it's specified by this court in Walker. You know, we believe that that Walker versus United States controls the outcome of this case. And so in Walker, this court said that where a recused chief judge takes action to influence the choice of his replacement, that's inconsistent with Canon 2A of the Code of Judicial Conduct, and this court prevented the succession of chief judgeship from proceeding in that case due to the inconsistency with the public perception. So we believe that this court's case law establishes
public perception or is it appearance of impartiality? Is it the judicial canon standard or is it some other standard?
Well, Your Honor, this court in Walker pointed to the judicial canon, so pointed to Canon 2A. And we believe that that is the standard for whether it was proper for Chief Judge Wise to take action.
I'm asking that because you've put a lot of emphasis on public perception and not on the canon standard.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the interference of public perception is inconsistent with Canon 2A. Canon 2A is designed, as this court pointed out in Walker, to protect public confidence in the judiciary. And also, if this court were to agree with us that there was error here, then certainly when you turn to remedy under the Liljeburg third factor, public confidence is there again. So we think that this court, and of course this court applied that factor in the Quintanilla case. So we believe that this court's case law points very much to public confidence in the system.
Did we, in fact, enunciate a standard in Walker? Or do we just cite the canons and say, bad?
This court cited the canons and said that what occurred in that instance was inconsistent with the canons and did not allow that designation to remain in place.
Okay. The two statements by the chief judge. The first one, you got two lines of precedent, we picked A, not B. What in that statement undercuts public confidence in the judiciary?
Your Honor, when he says they're treating this as a test case.
No, I thought that was the second. Okay.
That's part of the first, Your Honor.
Okay.
In the first statement, he said test case. Second case, he said power grab.
Right, okay. And now, what about that undercuts public confidence in the judiciary?
Yes, Your Honor.
Including the test case line.
The test case. A test case is an instance where a controversy is being forced for the purpose of getting a judicial resolution of that controversy.
Are you saying it's not a case or controversy? It's not a case of controversy.
Oh, no, Your Honor. No, Your Honor.
You're not saying it's a contrived case.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm saying that what the lower court did was they contrived a conflict.
No. That's not what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There are real parties in interest.
Yes, Your Honor.
There is an actual controversy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Constitutionally speaking.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Oh, of course.
Right.
Because there's a criminal conviction and
right.
This is an appeal of a criminal
right.
conviction.
Right. So I don't know what you are saying.
Okay. This is it, Your Honor. A test case is a contrived conflict. That's what the term test case means. And in this case, the lower court contrived a conflict between Moreno and May when one didn't
exist.
Why does
that matter? If there came a time when the judge decided he needed to recuse himself, and he recused himself, and he either acted consistent with that or not, why does it matter what the basis of the recusal was if in acting inconsistent with that recusal, we have a judge, you know, judges aren't supposed to do that. Either you are recused or you're not.
Yes, sir.
Is it necessary for us to decide he should have recused or not recused when, in fact, he did recuse?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It isn't.
Is my point? I mean, either you're recused or you're not.
And we agree with that entirely.
He can relitigate all the facts in the world, and it might have been a wise decision or a bad decision, but once you're recused, right?
And we agree with that, Your Honor. We would also point out that recusal was also implicated by the mere fact that the chief judge chose to publicly discuss the case twice, which itself violates the judicial canons. So it's not merely what he said, but the mere fact that he chose to speak, the mere fact that he chose to reveal a deliberative process is in and of itself irregular. And Your Honor, if the court would agree with us that there's error, when you get to applying the Liljeburg factors, then these issues about why may come into play.
Is this structural error?
No, Your Honor, because it's subject to a prejudice analysis under this
okay.
court's case law, so it must not be.
Counsel, would you explain why under the Liljeburg factors the specific words that may have been spoken have significance in this case?
Why the specific words have significance?
Right, under the Liljeburg. You said that
yes,
under the Liljeburg factors it would be significant as to the specific words that led to the recusal.
Yes, Your Honor. The third Liljeburg factor is the risk of undermining the public's confidence in the judicial process. And so the fact that the chief judge was indicating that the original panel was gaming the system, if you will, undermines public confidence in the system. Now, one of the reasons why
that doesn't answer my question. That may be a reason as to why he should have recused. But he did recuse, as was pointed out.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why are the specific words at issue in this case? Is the government, is the government contesting that the recusal was unnecessary or improper?
Oh, no, Your Honor.
So why are the specific words that were spoken important here?
Your Honor, we think that that we would win even without the the precise nature of the comments. But
yeah, my question that doesn't go to why it's in the brief, but whether it's decisional or not for us to focus on specific words.
Your Honor, we do believe that there is one reason why they are important to the court's analysis, and that is at the time. We moved to recuse Chief Judge Wise on August 22nd of 2008, and in that motion, we pointed to his second set of remarks, the power grab remarks, and we said, we're going to make an issue of this on the appeal. And so then when Chief Judge Wise influenced the choice of his replacement, he did so knowing that those remarks were going to be an issue. Now, one of the reasons why it's improper for a recused judge to influence the choice of his replacement is he could steer the case toward a judge who would be favorable to that judge's interest in the litigation. So we believe that it is important, the fact that Chief Judge Wise knew that the propriety of his remarks were going to be a play, because again, that gives rise to one of the evils of the individual's influencing the choice of his replacement, because he may steer it to a judge that he knows his jurisprudence.
So the case would be different if it happened to be a brother who was somehow involved in this case that caused for the recusal?
It wouldn't be different, Your Honor. Again, we feel that what happened here makes a situation where it's already inappropriate for him to do what he did, still worse. That's our only point, Your Honor. Almost regardless of the reason for recusal, there's going to be that concern that if the recused judge steers the case to a particular judge as his replacement, there's a concern that could be used as an effort to influence the outcome of the case in a manner that's favorable to the recused judge. And so that's going to be the case almost regardless of the reason for recusal.
So then the answer is the words don't matter other than to set the stage.
Well, again, Your Honor, we think it makes matters worse because of the incendiary nature of the language. We think the fact that this involved what we see as an admission of judicial impropriety, and then Chief Judge Wise steers the case knowing that judicial impropriety will be an issue on the appeal, makes it worse than what could have been some other basis for recusal, Your Honor.
As a matter of fact, have there been findings in fact in this case as to, number one, what words were said, and number two, whether steering, if any steering occurred, was done for either a malignant reason, as suggested, or for a neutral reason in terms of citing the rule and apparent belief that this was the next judge to serve as chief judge? That is, has there been any findings in this case as to what actually happened?
Your Honor, as the lower court found that the power grab statement was made, as to the second issue, no. This issue came up very late in the lower court's decision of this case. As this court knows, we had asked for these documents, we'd been turned down, we put in a motion for these documents, we'd been turned down, we put in a FOIA request for these documents, it was unsuccessful, we put in a FOIA appeal, and finally got these documents on the 14th of April as a result of that FOIA appeal. The same day we moved to vacate the designation of Chief Judge Wise. 10 days later, on the same day that it issued its opinion in this case, the lower court also denied that motion. So there were no findings of facts. We had earlier moved to depose Chief Judge Wise. It wasn't on this issue because we didn't have these documents yet, Your Honor. But we'd earlier moved to depose him. That motion had been denied. We'd moved for a debate hearing. That had been denied. So, no, there was no factual findings with regard to the reasons in this particular case. But I would point out, Your Honor mentioned the rule. I would point out that, and the government agrees with us on this point, the lower court's rule concerning who becomes chief judge in case of unavailability of the normal chief judge is inapplicable in this case. This isn't a case where the chief judge was unavailable. This is a case where the chief judge is recused. And the
that's a point of law that's being made that may or may not be accurate, but it doesn't stand for the proposition that the chief judge then recused did or did not believe that the rule was applicable in this case.
That's right, Your Honor. And we don't know that. And also, we don't know whether the Judge Advocate General knew that the rule was applicable or not in this case. Now, again, in either, the government agrees with our position, and the lower court also found that rule was not applicable. It's probably the one instance in which all three of us agree, Your Honor. But the error would arise in this instance regardless of the reason why Chief Judge Wise picked Judge Francis. The lack of confidence among the public would be the same regardless of what actually motivated Chief Judge Wise, particularly when one looks at everything that had happened in this case. Regardless of his subjective intent, it created an objective appearance of unfairness when Chief Judge Wise recommended one particular judge to serve his role as chief judge and get to hand-pick the other two members of the panel.
Okay, if this isn't structural error, where's the prejudice?
Your Honor, the prejudice was in the selection of Judge Francis itself.
Well,
and Your Honor, I mean, imagine, take for example the Supreme Court. Let's say the Supreme Court sat in panels of three. If I could choose which justice handpicked the other two members of that panel, I could control the outcome of any important case.
What you're really saying is that it is structural error.
Oh,
sure, sounds like structural error to me.
Oh, no, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. And so, for example, let's hypothesize that Chief Judge Wise had recommended Judge Francis, but instead of choosing Judge Francis, the Judge Advocate General chose Judge Thompson. There would have been an error in that instance, but it wouldn't have resulted in any prejudice, Your Honor. There would have been an attempt to influence the choice of his replacement, but ultimately that would have not have been prejudicial. And we would point to everything that the court did after this occurred as indicating the prejudice to appellant.
I'm confused. When I asked you earlier to discuss the difference of view between you and the government, you said that all you needed to show was an appearance of impartiality or lack of an appearance of whatever you're supposed to say.
Yes, sir.
But now you're saying, no, you're going to show us prejudice. Are you conceding that you are required to show prejudice?
No, Your Honor. I'm referring to the fact that prejudice is one of the factors on remedy. I might have muddled the line between error and remedy, so I apologize. The prejudice factor comes in at the remedy stage, Your Honor. But again, we do not believe that it is systemic error. Again, that someone could influence the choice of his replacement. The influence is unsuccessful. We would say there's not going to be any resulting reversal in that instance, Your Honor.
Are you alleging, or is there anything in the record that would suggest that there's any tie between the judges in question other than the fact they both serve on the same court?
Are they tied? I mean, we have it's cited in this case is the Anderson case, for example, Your Honor, where Chief Judge Wise and Judge Francis and Judge Brand, another member of the original panel.
I was asking whether there's something in the record. I'm not asking, I suppose I invited you to speculate, but I'm asking you, is that in fact your allegation, and is there something in the record to support it, that there's something more afoot here than just the fact that they are colleagues serving on the same court and he recommended who take his place?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired.
You can answer the question, and there may be others from the panel.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are no particular facts that, in fact, we believe the record indicates, Senior Judge Francis indicated on the record that he had no communications with Judge Wise about this instance after the recusal. We believe him. We take that at face value.
In other words, contrast something like Butcher, where there's a lot of additional facts in play.
Yes, sir. We're not alleging any facts beyond the fact that one, they were longtime colleagues, they remained colleagues throughout this incident, and again, the very fact that as the next senior judge, Judge Francis had a very well-developed jurisprudence that again might influence Chief Judge Wise in steering the case toward him.
And then, in your view, what is the basis for the government denying your request for the email? On what basis did they deny you access?
Did the government or the court, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
First the government, then the court.
The government's response was, we received your request, we politely declined. That's their entire basis, Your Honor.
Okay, and what was the basis on which the court declined?
The court purported
just
to...
seeing how you interpret what's been said, I'm not...
Yes, Your Honor. The court purported...
I want you to read to me. I want you to tell me how you interpret that.
Yes, Your Honor. The court purported to apply the Campbell factors and say that it wouldn't... I believe that how I construed what the court did was they essentially said, we looked at these, it wouldn't make a difference in the outcome, so you don't get them.
Campbell factors with emphasis on four.
Correct, Your Honor. Exactly.
You've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Roger Bruce. Colonel Cordova, Lieutenant Colonel Weber, Captain Osborne, and I have the privilege of representing the United States Air Force. In June 2008, this court returned the case to the Air Force Court to conduct a plenary review with assistance of counsel under Article 70. That is precisely what happened The Air Force Corps correctly decided the issues before this court today. It's time for this case to come to an end. Time is short with four issues, so I'll speak briefly to issue one first. Article 66A provides that the Judge Advocate General shall designate the Chief Judge, and that's what happened when he designated Judge Francis for the purposes of resolving this case. Lieutenant General Rives and Judge Advocate General properly fulfilled his Article 66A responsibilities when he made that designation. General Rives, a general officer and former appellate judge himself, who exercised Article 66 judicial authority for several years.
Does that mean that General Rives cleansed any concern about a recusal, or that, in your view, Judge Wise did not act inconsistent with the recusal? You follow?
Not quite, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, let me build it a different way. When did Chief Judge Wise recuse himself from the case?
25 August, Your Honor.
25 August? Was he recused at the time that he recommended that Judge Francis fill in for him?
He was, Your Honor.
He was recused. Okay. Was that consistent or not consistent, that recommendation, with a recusal?
Well, Your Honor, I think when we look at the entire facts of what happened, we do think it was permissible what took place. Colonel Wise sent what we believe was an administrative staffing request to Colonel Smith, the Judge Advocate General's executive officer.
Permissible and therefore not inconsistent with a recusal.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes,
sir. So that answers my question in the sense that General Rives' actions, in your view, it's not that they cleansed it was just further evidence of everybody doing what they're supposed to do.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Constable,
yes,
in Walker,
yes,
we said that when a judge was recused, the judge should not take any action to influence the selection of his or her successor. And it seems in your brief that what you're arguing here is that there may have been some influence, but it wasn't significant. And because of the status of Judge Rives and other things, it was okay. Is that correct? Or are you saying there was no influence at all?
Well, Your Honor, from the record, we believe there was no impermissible influence in this case.
Well, no, I'm not. I don't want impermissible. I want, was there influence here or wasn't there?
As the Air Force Court found, there was influence in that, in fact, in the email from Colonel Wise to Colonel Smith, he did, in his mind, under the Air Force Court rules, put forth the name of Judge Francis.
So that would mean there was some type of influence.
The Air Force Court so found, yes, Your Honor, and we don't take exception with that.
Okay. Okay.
But that nonetheless was consistent with a recusal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
But nonetheless, you take the view that that influence was consistent with a recusal.
Yes, Your Honor, because I think the focus under Walker ought to be on the Judge Advocate General. Are the actions that he took appropriate under Article 66 or not? And we believe they were. It's somewhat significant, we think, to note that the draft letter that Colonel Wise sent to Colonel Smith was changed by General Rives and his staff. I counted 9 different changes to the letter. In our view, General Rives acted as a intervening, superseding, and proper appointing authority when he designated.
Right. I'm still hung up on my first question, though, which is, it's one thing to argue that General Rives fixed, cleansed, satisfied, did something with whatever had occurred, but I've heard you argue that Judge Wise was acting consistent with his recusal when he was sending that recommendation. And
well, yeah,
that's an important thing. If military judges either do or do not recuse, and if a recusal means you recuse except for those things that aren't really important, it's hard to know where the line is.
Yes, Your Honor. We place the focus, though, on General Rives. We think Article 66 requires us to do that, and that's exactly what this Court said in Walker, that TJAG has to make the designation, and that's what took place. So we place the focus on General Rives, Your Honor.
But isn't the real focus here on Judge Wise's actions? I mean, that's what we're here talking about, whether or not this was a recusal that required him not to interfere any further in any aspect of the case.
Well, as we understand the appellant's claim, it's the public perception.
Well, that's the prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
But what we're talking about now is whether or not this was a proper action to take once a judge has been recused. And it seems to me, in reading Walker and your responses, that there was, in the CCA opinion, that there was some influence.
We can't deny that, Your Honor, because he did, in fact, set forward a name.
And so given the language that we have in Walker, how much influence is okay? How much, I mean, where do we draw the line there? Where do judges know where to draw the line? Isn't it better for us to say, you just can't do it? You can't influence the selection of your successor, and then we have a bright line, and we're not going to have any more of these cases.
Well, Your Honor, I guess keeping our focus on General Rives, and then I guess going to the prejudice question, we think that what happened in this place, in this case, was proper. We think a proper designation was made. We think that this appellant, as the Air Force Corps found, was not prejudiced by it. What was the first thing, of course, that Judge Francis did? He removed the case from the panel that Judge Wise had previously referred this case to and created a brand new special panel of judges who had nothing to do with this case before, completely untainted by any prior participation. And when you couple that with what General Rives did and the fact that this appellant was in no way prejudiced, we think that the action ultimately was proper and that no relief would be warranted.
But why can't you say that the action on the part of Colonel Weiss was not proper, but it was nonetheless fixed by what happened thereafter and that there was no prejudice? I mean, I don't see why you want to defend or feel that you need to defend what Colonel Weiss did in order to make your argument as to why the appellant should not win.
I'm not being very articulate, Your Honor. You're right, I don't need to defend because, frankly, it doesn't matter because of what General Rives did and because of a lack of any impact in this case. That's the ultimate point that I would like to make today.
But what about the public perception? I mean, it would be very hard for the appellant to establish that, in fact, this particular panel was somehow prejudiced. But I think what we're talking about here is the third to Lilliput, how do you pronounce it?
Liljeburg.
Liljeburg. Element, which is whether or not it would diminish the public's opinion of the appellate procedure.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there, if a judge recuses themselves, there must be a reason for that. And the reason is that they can the result of it is that they should no longer be able to participate in the case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then when a judge does that, doesn't that have an effect on how the public will view it?
Your Honor, I think not under the facts of this case. I think if a reasonable member of the public was armed with the facts of General Rives' participation and the actions that he took, the fact that he and his staff changed the letter that was sent to him by from Colonel Wise to Colonel Smith, and they throw in the fact that
Were they substantive changes? I mean, what were the changes? They didn't change the name of the judge.
No, Your Honor, but they reflect an independent action by the proper appointing authority. And we think that that's significant. It wasn't a rubber stamp, oh, Colonel Wise said do this, I did it. It was, no, I'm taking an objective look at this, fulfilling my requirements that Article 6 imposed upon me as the TJAG.
Counsel, why does it have to be a rubber stamp in order to be prejudicial? We have in this case a judge who said certain words, and what precise words were said may be a matter of dispute, but they were sufficient to cause that judge to recuse. After he recused himself, according to your brief on page 6, it appears that the judge there are two different aspects of what might have happened. One is he merely sent a letter saying, this is the next chief judge, go ahead and designate him, a mere administrative matter. But on page 6 of your brief, it indicates that the judge advocate general had discretion to appoint any of the judges of that court or even appoint a new judge, so that this was not a matter of merely providing the judge advocate general with administrative information, I'm recused, here's the next person, but providing with a recommendation for a particular person. So you have a judge who said words which were of sufficient import to cause that judge to recuse. That judge, who is a senior military officer and the chief judge of a court, has now made a recommendation to the judge advocate general to appoint a specific person to sit as the chief judge on that court, and to be the judge who would then designate who would sit on that particular case. Under what circumstance would it ever be appropriate for a recused judge to make a recommendation as to who should be the successor to that chief judge after the judge has recused, when the recommendation is made to a person who has discretion in exercising the designation of the position?
Well, Your Honor, although TJAG did not make the appointment pursuant to the Air Force court rules, he made it pursuant to 66, Colonel Wise did reference the Air Force court rules as the reason why he put forth the name of Judge Francis. And we think that indicates it was not a nefarious intent on the recused judge.
Does it have to be a matter of nefarious intent? Where in the our precedents or in any precedent about the actions that can be taken by a recused judge, that intent is the test as opposed to taking an action which is not authorized?
Well, we do believe that would be important on determining whether there was any prejudice or not, Your Honor. And frankly, if the focus
don't we have to then have a Dubé hearing and try to figure out who said what to whom under what circumstance and why?
I don't think a Dubé is necessary, given that the chief judge cited the Air Force court rule as the reason he set forth that particular name. And I think a reasonable member of the public would see that was the rationale for suggesting Judge Francis.
Wouldn't a reasonable member of the public reading your brief realize that, no, the Judge Advocate General had complete discretion here, and that that's not necessarily the reason why the person was being recommended, that it was a convenience? Now, so how do we know what the answer is until someone's done a hearing?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that the record reflects it well enough. I just don't know that a hearing was going to add anything beyond what the record already demonstrates.
Going beyond the hearing, if this court were to return the case to the Air Force for a hearing before a panel that did not include any of the judges who had previously acted on the case, would that eliminate any need for addressing the other issues in this case? Would we have to have discovery? Would we have to have a hearing? Would that remove those issues? Not necessarily the issue of a proper appellate delay.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not able to agree that that is required.
I'm not asking you whether it's required. I said if we did that.
Well, certainly, Your Honor. Yeah, certainly. If I may turn the issue forward.
Before you leave it. Does our decision in Matthews have any relevance here? You know, in Matthews, you had a judge testifying about his internal mental processes. Here you have a judge blurting out his internal mental processes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that have any relevance here?
Well, it seems the appellant has conceded no in his brief that the affidavit is properly before the court, and in fact, they specifically point to Matthews in their brief that indicating that it's not a problem. But I think the Air Force Court handled it in such a way that it is not a problem, because first they articulated the rule that a judge can't, by his out-of-court statements, can't attack the findings of a judicial panel. But then they said, assuming arguendo that it can be done, they still found no error. So I think the manner in which the Air Force Court handled it. It is not a problem, Your Honor. And the defense doesn't concede a problem under
no case.
Now, I think in your brief you make the distinction or argument that at some point Judge Wise became Colonel Wise.
Yes, Your Honor.
And therefore was not required to follow, what, the judicial canons anymore?
He became a witness because of the manner in which he was challenged by the appellant.
And therefore, he can decide when a judge on the CCA recuses from a case, then they're merely a colonel, and they can walk around and comment on the case and do whatever they can do?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding of Matthews is that when there is an allegation of judicial impropriety, that it is permissible for a judge to be able to respond to such an allegation.
That's fair. I'm trying to get at this notion I'm wary of this notion that you're either a judge or a colonel, and that when you are recused from a case, you're merely a colonel. Are you not still, is it not the government's position that you're still obliged to follow the judicial canons?
Oh, no, Your Honor. Recusal alone isn't the test. I think it's the allegation of judicial impropriety that turned him into a witness. And therefore
into a witness, but a witness who is still who's still a CCA judge who's still obliged to follow the judicial canons.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I just wanted to test that because it seemed like it's sometimes in briefs like an email, things can come off a lot more terse than perhaps they're intended.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it sounded a bit like you were leaving the judicial canons in the black robe at the door.
Understand, Your Honor.
And that's not the case. I've misread the brief in that sense.
Well, we think he's entitled to defend himself.
Right, which is different than saying he's left the judicial canons.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand. Okay. Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I know you wanted to address issue four, but I have a question about the correctness of the decision of the court below with respect to its sentence comparison analysis when it said that it was going to look at adjudged sentences, not approved sentences. Where in the Uniform Code of Military Justice does it say that the responsibility of the Court of Criminal Appeals is to look at adjudged rather than approved sentences, as opposed to looking at both of them?
Well, I don't think Article 66 specifically delineated that.
Where in the legislative history does the Congress say that the only function of the Court of Criminal Appeals in deciding sentence appropriateness is to look at adjudged rather than approved sentences?
Your Honor, I think it's fair to say that the Air Force Court relied upon precedent of this court, precedent of all the service courts.
And did any of the cases that they cite from our court say that you don't look at approved sentences?
They say you look at adjudged sentences.
And in those cases, in those cases, weren't those all cases in which the adjudged and the approved sentences were the same? Were there any cases in which there was an approved sentence in which our court said don't look at the approved, only look at the adjudged?
No, Your Honor, I don't think this court ever said do not look at approved, but it did say specifically you look at adjudged, and that's exactly what the Air Force Court did.
And you're responding in the context of what you look at it when the claim is a disparate sentence in closely related cases, right? Not just whether or not you look at everything when you're doing your 66 review.
Correct, Your Honor. It's only under that analysis.
Isn't it within the power of the convening authority, indeed one of the powers that was expected that the convening authorities would act in light of World War II, to adjust disparate sentences within the command?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if the convening authority has adjusted disparate sentences within the command or allegedly has failed to adjust disparate sentences within the command, why wouldn't you look at the sentences as approved by the convening authority as opposed to simply what was adjudged within that command?
Well, Your Honor, clemency is a matter for solely reserved for the convening authority.
Where does it say in the Uniform Code of Military Justice or legislative history that the only function of the convening authority is clemency?
That's the only function?
Right. In other words, when a convening authority is making an adjustment in sentences for sentence appropriateness, when the convening authority determines that one sentence is too high or another one is too low within a command and makes an adjustment in that regard in lowering a particular sentence, that's not clemency, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I think it may or may not be.
And what if it isn't? What if the commander is simply concerned with fairness within the command? He has no interest at all in taking clemency with a particular individual with respect to any mercy in that regard, but says, I want to have an even distribution of sentences within my command. There's no clemency involved there, so why wouldn't we have the courts of criminal appeals do the same thing that the convening authority does in terms of applying the approved sentences for purposes of uniformity of sentence? Doesn't say that they can't look at the judge sentences, but it appears to me that the Court of Criminal Appeals has said we won't look at the approved sentence even if the command has a disparate sentences within the command and the commander has failed to act to adjust those.
Well, Your Honor, our position has always been, and it remains, that the Air Force Court followed precedent, and I really don't have anything further to add.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question on that same line, which is, it appears to me from reading Article 60 and from reading RCM 1107 that the convening authority can take action on an adjudged sentence for myriad reasons, and one of them might be sentence appropriateness, and one of them might be clemency, and one of them might be mercy. We don't know what the reasons that they take the actions that they are might be in a particular case. And I guess my question is, given that fact and given that what the CA does in his action is a matter solely within his own prerogative, how would or how could a CCA compare approved sentences?
Your Honor, I don't think the CCA can do that. It's outside their lane. And that's because the judge sentences are what the public sees, what's announced in the courtroom. The public doesn't see what is done in the privacy of the convening authority's office. Nobody is privy to that except the convening authority, and so how can you ever make a meaningful comparison? You cannot.
Well, I guess the question that I have is, at least I didn't see in the government brief any reference to Article 60 or RCM 1107, and I'm wondering why that would be. Did you just not think that we needed to consider those things?
Well, Your Honor, I guess we relied upon the prior precedent of this court and the precedent of all the service courts that we thought fairly clearly stated the standard was to follow the judge sentences.
So if the sentence in one case of a drug case is 10 years and another case it's 1 year as the approved sentence, you're saying that the Court of Criminal Appeals is disabled from making a sentence appropriateness analysis, taking into account those two approved sentences coming out of the same command, same unit?
Your Honor, we're saying they're not equipped to make those kind of sentences.
Are you saying they're precluded from doing it as a matter of law?
I would say yes, in light of the case law and in light of the fact that they don't have the ability to meaningfully make those comparisons. Those matters are simply not placed in the record of trial. The thought processes, the rationales, the intentions of the convening authority are not privy to the service courts.
Never put in the staff judge advocate's review or recommendation.
That is in there, but ultimately we don't know what persuaded or did not persuade a convening authority. That's not a matter of record. And it seems like it would be very
How do we know whatever persuaded a judge or a court member when under the military justice system they can sentence anywhere from no punishment up to the maximum, which may be dozens of years?
Well, Your Honor, you're left with a public record. You're left with the facts that are in the record, and then you're left with an adjudged sentence. And you can compare those matters of record to the sentence to make that determination. You can never make a similar comparison when it comes to clemency, when it comes to approved sentences, because those matters are not.
Is that the position of the Department of Defense, that the courts of criminal appeals are disabled from looking at approved sentences and making sentence comparison for sentence appropriateness purposes?
Well, Your Honor, I can't speak for the Department of Defense, but that is the position that the Air Force has taken.
Thank you.
You may briefly conclude.
I really wish we could have got to issue four, quite frankly.
What would you have said on issue four?
You can take whatever time you need on issue four.
Are you sure about that, Your Honor?
Don't take whatever time. Take
no.
Make your
no, you make you can take the time you need to address issue four if the government believes that issue four is an important issue in this case for us to address. Don't feel rushed. Take the time and make
your
presentation.
We think issue four is really the essence of this case. It has been from the trial level, the initial appellate stages through the appellate process. This has all been about Moreno, quite frankly, and we really think it's worthy of mentioning it. The appellant raises a Moreno claim and then really doesn't even address it in his
brief. What are your two bullets here?
Pardon?
What are your two bullets, the two things you want us to think about when we think about this issue?
Well, bullet number one is it's an absurd Moreno claim because he loses on issues 1, 2, 4 of Barker. Issue or factor three is neutral, and the Air Force Corps correctly refused to grant Article 66 relief under debate. It's a meritless claim that brought us here today. That really started back when the original appellate defense counsel made his request for Moreno without ever having read this simple record of
what
trial.
What is it that you have to add that isn't already in your brief? That's important for you to tell us that we don't already have in your brief.
What's important, Your Honor, that's not in our brief is we think that this case has been a pretty clear example of appellate sport that has taken place for a couple of years. We think that the appellant has argued that the public confidence has been shaken by the manner in which this appeal has been handled, and nothing could be further from the truth. Two different appellate courts have issued what will now be the fourth opinion in about 3 years, addressing every issue raised by this appellant. Certainly he has a right to raise appellate issues. We don't deny him that. But this appellant, in this very simple 81-page record of trial, judging on guilty plea PTA case, has attacked everyone and everything involved in the process. And even today, what does he want? He wants to prolong that appellate process so he can be heard later on to complain that his appeal took too long. We think that enough is enough. We think that sport needs to come to an end here today, and the only proper way to do it is to affirm the very well reasoned, thought out, and articulated decision of the Air Force Court in their 20-page opinion.
Well, rather than call it appellate support, I think it would be more fair to call it zealous advocacy. I mean, I would hope that if you were an appellant in a case, that you would want your appellate counsel to work as hard on your behalf.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I'm a former appellate defense counsel myself, and I understand and respect that role. But with the kinds of issues that we've seen throughout these proceedings, whether it was the original appellate counsel who was ultimately responsible for the initial delay, or whether it is trying to send it back for a debate hearing to resolve conflicts in an affidavit that simply does not exist, there's a whole laundry list of things that took place in this case that just don't make a lot of sense.
Well, you don't disagree that the government hasn't helped itself along the way, do you? You don't disagree that Colonel Weiss's comments did not help bring this case to a close, or that his comment to the Judge Advocate General didn't help bring this case to a close?
I completely agree, Your Honor. If Colonel Weiss had kept his mouth shut, things would be a whole lot better. I absolutely agree with you.
Counsel, this might be a good time for you to summarize your case.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand. To summarize, enough is enough. He's had his due process. The Air Force Court got it right, and we respectfully ask you to affirm their decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Before you start, counsel, my question is, let's say that we gave you one of the things that you wanted and were to send this case back to be reviewed in the first instance by a completely new panel. What substantive issue, unrelated to Colonel Weiss and unrelated to the Judge Advocate General of the Air Force, do you claim that appellant could prevail on?
First, Your Honor, sentence appropriateness, and for two reasons. One, there is a disparity between appellant sentence and NEF sentence. That disparity was greater at the action stage, and the lower court has never made a sentence disparity analysis at the action stage. And two, we know under Tardif that the court can consider the appellate delay in this case in the course of making a sentence appropriateness determination. And we also know under Ryder this court can't foreclose. You know, it's not this court's job to make a sentence appropriateness determination. It's the lower court's. So what we're asking for, the central thing we're seeking, is a remand of the lower court to make a sentence appropriateness analysis in the first instance in front of a court that's been fairly appointed. That's what we want.
And what is it about Colonel Weiss's comments or anything to do with the convening authority's action, the Judge Advocate General's action in this case that showed any bias or commentary with respect to that particular issue?
Well, none, Your Honor. But again, our concern is in the steering, that when the recused judge steers the case to a particular judge, that judge is doing so with, you know, the fear is the judge does so with that fear, with that goal in mind. You know,
that the new chief judge would have a particular view towards sentence appropriateness and Tardif?
Oh, no, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I'm saying that the chief judge would steer it to a judge that perhaps, and we're not saying this necessarily happened, but again, under Caperton, it's what the public would believe had happened, that they might steer it to a judge that would be less likely to order search and discovery, that would be less likely to order a debate hearing, that would be less likely to subject them to a deposition.
But all of those things go to the issue that I asked you to talk about. What did you want, irrespective of Colonel Weiss and who the judges were on the previous panel?
Yes, Your Honor, but the concern is that when you steer it to that judge may also be adverse to the appellant on other issues.
But what about Colonel Weiss's comments showed that he was adverse to the appellant on any issue, as opposed to had a particular view of the law that he wanted this court to address?
Oh, Your Honor, we think that his comments indicated that he was treating appellant as a lab rat. When he calls this a test case, when he says it was a power grab, he's treating the appellant as a pawn in that power grab.
Well, it sounded like he was, that from his perspective, he was trying to treat this court like a pawn.
Well, that may also be the case, Your Honor, but our belief is that he forgot that there's a real person named Charles Roach that this case affects, and he was instead treating this airman that he'd never met as a lab rat for his test case and a pawn in his power grab, and that's our concern, Your Honor.
Counsel, your time has expired, but we did give the government additional time, and without making this open-ended, you can take the time you needed to make your rebuttal.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I want to make, with the court's indulgence, first I want to point out that the argument that the government made here about Rule 1.3 is exactly contrary to the argument they made in their brief at pages 6 through 7. And in fact, in pages 6 through 7 of the government brief, the government described the argument the counsel just made as an unwarranted assumption. It's important to note that there was no written input to the Judge Advocate General of the Air Force other than Chief Judge Wise's email to Colonel Smith and his draft. Three, when you compare the drafts and the final letter, and one is at page 118 of the Joint Appendix, and the other is at page 303, the bodies of those two documents are identical. Word for word identical, they're just formatting changes in the body. And the final point I'd like to make, Your Honor, the question came out about what would be the effect if this court sent the case back to the lower court? What would be the effect for new review? What would be the effect on the other issues? And our view is, if that happened, there would be no reason for this court to address issue 3. There would be no reason for this court to address issue 4. Obviously, there would be no obligation of the court to address issue 2, but we would nevertheless urge this court to address issue 2, even if it sends it back, because the lower court obviously believes it's constrained by this court's use of the word adjudged not to look at approved sentences. We understand this is a good faith interpretation of this court's case. Well, we disagree with it, but they're constrained. They've come out in the published case of Anderson and said we won't look at approved sentences. So if this court's...
You read their thing as saying we won't look at approved sentences when looking at sentence appropriateness, or we won't look at approved sentences when doing closely related disparate Lacey analysis?
The latter, Your Honor. The latter.
This case does not then, in your view, involve the issue of whether the lower court is disabled from looking at approved sentences?
No, Your Honor. No. The court said that it could not, under this court's case law, it could not look at approved sentences for purposes of sentence disparity analysis. And we believe that's wrong. So if this court were to send this case back to the lower court to do a sentence for a redo without addressing issue 2, then we'd have Roach 5 below, and then we'd have the risk of Roach 6.
Is the lower court required by our precedent to look at approved sentences as opposed to having the discretion in a particular case to look at an approved sentence to determine whether that affects sentence disparity?
Your Honor, we believe the latter. But again, the concern is that the lower court construes this court's case law as saying you may not look there. And the final point with regard to that, Your Honor, and this is my final point, absent any other questions from the court. Imagine a hypothetical where there's one unit that has a number of people who go to court-martial, some officers, some enlisted. All of them receive punitive discharges. And the convening authority commutes all of the dismissals of the officers and approves all of the BCDs and DDs of the enlisted members. We believe that falls within the heartland of what Article 66 was about. And yet, under the lower court's analysis, they would say, we can't look at what happened at the CA stage, and they would treat those cases as having identical sentences because all received the punitive discharge. And that identifies, in our view, why it's important to let the court look at the approved sentences. And absent any other further questions, that concludes our argument.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:30 a.m.